Welcome to Island Crimes and Mysteries. And now, it's time to join your host, Newells, for another episode.
Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. I want to thank you for joining me today, and if you're a returning listener, I want to say a big thank you for your continued support. If this is your first time listening to my podcast, welcome. It's great to have you on board. So without further ado, let's get started on today's story. Right guys, before we start today's episode, I would love to give a big shout out to my newest Patreon members. Badly Drawn Eyebrows, love that name. Claire and Billy Fitzpatrick. You are very welcome to our little community. Now, if anybody else would like to join that little community, go on over to my Patreon page at patreon.com/Ireland Crimes and Mysteries and have a look at the tiers and decide which one suits you best. There's different perks with each of them, like ad-free episodes, bonus episodes, and a monthly live stream also for the platinum tier people. So yeah, go on over and have a look. And obviously, alternatively, if you want to become a free member, we'd love to have you on board too. So thanks again to my new Patreon members, and I look forward to getting to know ye. Right, back to today's episode. Dear sir, my poor unfortunate wife having died after an illness of 10 or 12 days in which she was attended by Drs. Quinn and Kitson, and having heard insinuations as to the cause of her death, although her death was not that sudden, yet I am most anxious that an investigation should be held, as I consider it to the public and also my own satisfaction. May I therefore request you will consider it a case to hold an inquest, as my sole wish is to have a fair, open, impartial and public investigation into her death. I know you will get a respectable and impartial jury on the occasion. These are the words contained in a letter written by Dr. Charles Langley to his neighbour James Carl, who happened to be the local coroner, 3 days before his wife Ellen died, and delivered on the day she died to offset any rumours after her death. Dr. Charles Langley was a prosperous local doctor of high standing in society, who thought he could get away with murder. But thinking it and actually getting away with it are two entirely different beasts. But ultimately, the decision by a jury of his peers would shock everyone. So who were this high societal couple? Dr. Charles Langley's wife, Ellen Poe, was born in 1791 in Donnybrook to William Parsons Poe and Frances Harden, a very respectable couple. She was the second youngest of 9 children. Tragedy would beset the Poe family in 1795, when Ellen was just 4 years old, when her mother Frances would pass away. So Ellen would grow up without that maternal influence. Daughters of respectable families in those days were expected to marry within their own class and marry someone with prospects and from an equally respectable family. Marrying for love was not on the agenda. Ellen would have to find a suitable husband. Slowly but surely, all of her siblings would get married, but Ellen, by 1830 and at the age of 39, was still unmarried. This was very unusual for the time, and Ellen would now be considered a spinster, her father being the one responsible for keeping her. But when he died in 1830, the responsibility of Ellen's upkeep passed to her brothers. Her brother William had been left the house in Donnybrook, but prior to his father's death had financial problems and had to rent the house out to tenants. The fact his father had charged the estate for the dowries of his daughters on their marriages added to William's financial woes, as he was now responsible for fulfilling his father's final wishes. This was the equivalent of 2 years' rental income, and on her marriage, Ellen would get £500 as a dowry, an enormous sum for the cash-strapped brother to come up with. Ellen was by now living with relatives in Dublin. Her exact address was unknown, but it is thought that she lived near Merriam Square. Her brother William's daughter was living on Merriam Square as well with her husband and a 1-year-old baby, while her sister Mary Ann was living in Denzil Street with her husband Edward Nixon. According to the Metropolitan magazine, This part of Dublin had an aristocratic aspect with opulent mansions. This area opened up new opportunities for Ellen socially. The social season in Dublin was between October and May, and Ellen, despite her age, was not giving up on her dream of finding a suitable husband of means. She would enjoy the parties at various high society mansions and was becoming well known in these circles. But her quest to find a husband was not as prosperous. That was until she met a man named Charles Langley. Charles also came from a well-to-do family. Originally from Limerick, he was now also living in Dublin. Charles was the son of Jeremiah Langley and Lydia Taylor. His father's family were a wealthy Protestant family from Lismanrock in County Tipperary. But Jeremiah and Lydia would move to Limerick, where Jeremiah would practice law. But again, as with Ellen, Charles's father died when he was 13 in 1819, followed by his older brother in 1827, leaving him as the only male in the family having to tend financially to his mother and sisters. In 1830, Charles received his license to practice medicine at the Royal College of Surgeons in Dublin. Then in 1831, after a meeting of the dispensary board in Nina, Charles Langley would be appointed as the doctor. It is thought it is through his uncle, who was also called Charles Langley, who held a lot of sway in Thurles, which was not too far from Nina, that helped secure the position for him. That same year of 1831, Ellen's brother-in-law, who happened to also be her cousin, moved from Hackettstown in Carlow to Nina as the new Protestant rector for the town. He was married to Ellen's sister Frances. Although it would be frowned upon today, back in those days, high society did not think it was too unusual to marry your cousin. They were of the idea that it would keep the bloodline pure. Of course, we know different nowadays. But nevertheless, Reverend Poe moved to Nina the same year as Dr. Langley. Now, it's not known how Ellen and Charles actually met, but it can be assumed that it was through his association with Reverend Poe. But 8 months later, after starting his new position at the dispensary, Charles would marry Ellen, who was 15 years older than him. The marriage took place at St. Peter's Church on Ogner Street in Dublin on the 12th of December 1831, officiated over by the Venerable Edward Barton. Ellen's brother and niece and other family members had previously been married there. A marriage settlement had been drawn up before the marriage took place by a solicitor in Charlemont Street. Charles would receive £1,000 from the family estate in Tipperary, and Ellen would bring the £500 allocated to her by her father in his will, which would be charged to the family estate, much to her brother's disdain. She would also bring a further £300 from a debt owed to her father by Reverend Poe's older brother. Not a huge amount, but enough to give them a bit of yearly interest. Charles's salary from the dispensary would have to supplement it. A lot of people thought that this union was an odd one, from the very, very start. Firstly, the age gap of 15 years. She had been from a highly respected family. Was it to gain respect in the area that he had married Ellen? Charles had hated his job. He hated having to go out and treat the poor and the destitute, who more often than not lived in absolute squalor, where disease was rife. Nina in those times, like most Irish towns, was full of starving people who lived in alleyways and side streets or overcrowded rooms. Sanitation was zero, and as I said, the spread of disease was rampant, especially once the famine took hold. A lot of people who lived in rural settings relocated to the towns in the hope of getting more help, often seeking shelter in the already overcrowded workhouses. Although some people would rather have died on the street than spend even a day in the workhouse. The massive increase in the populations of these towns only aided the spread of diseases such as cholera, and also saw an increase in criminal activity, with Tipperary being one of the most dangerous counties during this time period. So, as you can imagine, Charles was not particularly happy having to visit these desolate and dirty places, even though it was his job. He looked for alternative ways to make money and decided on money lending as a lucrative approach to bringing in more money. There were a lot of desperate people at this time who would do anything for a few shillings, but the problem was, how would most of them pay Charles back? he would become ruthless in his pursuit of payment, often having people who could not pay him arrested and only to be released when they could get the money to pay him back. Charles was taking advantage of these poor people who were desperate. He would often demand double the amount originally owed, which he more than likely knew would be impossible for these people to pay back. He would also make people who procured medicines from him pay well over the odds for what they received. Charles was already showing himself to be an unlikable, shady character. It had not gone unnoticed by the commission that he was not carrying out his doctor duties adequately at this time of mass disease and death, but only looked to be trying to profit from people's misfortune. So a meeting was held by the commission and the decision was made to remove Dr. Charles Langley from the Nina dispensary. But instead of being devastated by this decision, Charles took it as an opportunity to grow his lending business. And alongside this, the job of local coroner, working on the Crown's behalf as the expert medical witness in various crimes that would take place. And believe me, back then, there were a lot. Despite being not well liked in the poorer sections of society, Charles was still well respected by his own class, the landowners and the business owners. They all mingled together and stuck together while the poor struggled and died around them. So all in all, despite losing his job at the dispensary, Charles was doing well, both socially and financially. And by all accounts, the first 9 months of his marriage to Ellen seemed to be uneventful. But before the year was out, servants had started to notice Charles was getting physically abusive with Ellen. He seemed quick to temper and by all accounts was taking his anger out on his wife. One servant claiming that on one occasion he actually saw Charles drag Ellen by the ponytail, grab a scissors and cut off her riding habit. He then proceeded to lock her into a room. The servant said Ellen screamed the place down for the rest of the day. He went on to say that locking her in her room became more and more frequent and sometimes would be for days. The only kindness she would experience was from her servants, who when Charles was out, would bring her food. Other than that, she would have not eaten anything. The abuse understandably distressed the servants very much, as more often than not, they were powerless to help. One servant saying that he would often just treat her badly on a whim. Ellen would have given him no cause to act out in such a violent and aggressive way. On one occasion, a servant named Quigley said he tried to break the door down to let her out, but Charles caught him and an altercation ensued, with Quigley saying Charles hit him with a large iron key, before Quigley got the upper hand and gave Charles a good hiding. As you can imagine, Quigley lost his job after this. And effectively, one of Ellen's allies was gone. Charles would later say that the reason he was so hard on Ellen is that she had had relations with two men prior to their marriage and he resented her for this fact. This could never be substantiated and Ellen never confirmed or denied this fact. Nevertheless, it was no excuse for the abuse that she was receiving. The abuse continued over the next 17 years, both physical and mental abuse. It appeared that Dr. Langley was growing more and more resentful of the fact he had married a much older Ellen. It did not stop him from having various affairs throughout his marriage, though. These affairs also often witnessed by the servants. Some of these indiscretions were actually with some of the maids. Ellen would go on to get tuberculosis, a disease that her mother had already succumbed to all those years before. Despite surviving it, she was left with ongoing digestive issues, which were only exacerbated by Charles's restriction of food, which was something he also did when he locked her away for days. He sometimes only allowed her to eat brown bread, and this caused her untold problems. Often Ellen would knock on a neighbour's door asking for something to eat, so desperate from the hunger she was experiencing. Charles would then contact these neighbours and tell them in no uncertain terms to stop giving his wife food. As Charles was respected amongst his peers, they would not question him, and most of the neighbours would turn her away unless they knew for sure Charles was not at home. From the outside looking in, people would say that the kind-hearted Ellen was a good wife and only wanted to make her husband happy, but it appeared that Charles most definitely did not feel the same. At some point in the marriage, Charles's young niece Franny moved in with them. But the fact she was living with them did not change how Charles treated his wife. In actual fact, if his niece saw one of the servants giving her food, she would tell Charles. He was also continuing on with his affairs, often seen bringing women into the house. Then in 1848, Charles started an affair with Ellen's 32-year-old niece, Anna, known as Nanny. She was the daughter of the Reverend Poe and his wife, Ellen's sister, Frances. It was around this time that Parliament was also debating to change the incest laws. The first proposal being presented in 1832, but the new penal law was not actually acted upon until 1864. But people were aware of the fact that it was being debated, and people's attitudes towards close family relationships were beginning to change. Once the act was passed, a person who had relations with their spouse's niece would get a fine. It was seen as a lesser crime, but still frowned upon by society. Ellen would eventually find out about this affair and immediately told her sister and brother-in-law. They were horrified and immediately set about ensuing that this relationship went no further. In December 1848, Charles visited their house to see Anna, but he was turned away. Knowing that Ellen was more than likely the person who had given up his secret, he was enraged. He set about talking to his brother-in-law, who was married to Ellen's sister, Marianne, about divorcing Ellen. He advised Charles on his rights if he did decide to go ahead with a divorce. Charles set about telling anyone that would listen to him that Ellen was spreading vicious rumours about him, that she'd been saying he was a player and that he was abusing her, all of which he denied, saying that she was only out to ruin his reputation. This, it appears, was Charles trying to lay down the groundwork for grounds for divorce. And it was during this time that Ellen had on one occasion received a brutal beating from Charles, and she'd been sent off to another prominent family to recuperate. Of course, this beating wasn't spoken about in the elite circles, as they viewed protecting the doctor's reputation over protecting his wife to be more important. By this stage, Ellen's life was becoming so intolerable, but it was about to get even more intolerable for her. The cruel doctor, still hell-bent on a relationship and possible marriage to Ellen's niece Anna, and with his disdain and by now probable hatred for his wife growing stronger by the day, sets about his plan to erase Ellen from his life. He moved her up into the attic, where she was allowed to eat a little bit more than she was before. Eggs and brown bread usually. Again, the servants tried their best to bring her more food. And sometimes when Charles was out, they'd even bring her down to the parlour to eat. But Charles again gets word of this and moves her downstairs to a room opposite a man named Thomas Pound. Thomas worked for the Langleys as a servant and was an ex-con, having served time in jail for assault. He would, however, become a key witness in what would transpire at the inquest and subsequent trial. Thomas had also been bringing the now emaciated Ellen eggs to eat. Every one of the servants was appalled by the conditions Ellen was forced to endure. The room was freezing and all Ellen had on was a chemise and one sheet to cover her to keep her warm. Sometimes the maid would try and sneak up a heat jar to try and keep Ellen warm. But she too was caught by his niece Franny, and she would duly report back to Charles that this was happening, and he would put a stop to it immediately. Thomas, despite his history, did feel sorry for Ellen. He could not understand what she had done to deserve such a treatment. He would go into the room and rub her feet and cuddle her to try and warm her up. This is when the alleged indiscretion on Ellen's behalf is supposed to have happened. Now, to me, I can't see how at this point anything would have happened, as Ellen was so weak and cold and in an awful state. But Ellen seemingly too had said they were intimate, but how intimate, we don't know. Charles, having found out about this indiscretion, was determined to prove in his divorce that Ellen was unfaithful. He got Thomas Pound to sign a declaration in return for a new suit and a new job, saying that he had relations with Ellen, after he had initially refused to sign anything. He called on Dr. Quinn to check on his wife's health after this, and not knowing the torture Ellen had been through, but hearing the story about her dalliance with Thomas Pound, he was more of the opinion Ellen had a sexually transmitted condition and that Thomas Pound was probably the culprit. He was very bothered by the overall physical condition that he found Ellen in and sought the advice of other doctors as to how to proceed with treatment. The servants were advised to bring her nourishing food to try and build her up. Initially, Ellen started to improve, but then Charles would step in and put a halt to her treatment and she would start to relapse. One of her maids would even later say that Ellen always got her to taste the tea before she drank it because she was convinced Charles was trying to poison her. He had started making her a cup of tea every morning. Then, at another stage, on hearing a story about a lady that had died by falling from an upstairs window, it is alleged that Charles said to Ellen that if she was to try to kill herself from falling out the window, she would need to be higher up in the building, as the room that she was currently in was not high enough, and she would only hurt herself but not die. It was like he was almost encouraging her to end her own life. Not long after her alleged indiscretion with Thomas Pound, Charles decided to throw Ellen out of the house and he put her up in a substandard cheap damp lodgings in the town and gave her a meagre allowance, not enough to survive on by any means. And at this time, there had been another outbreak of cholera in the town. So he was probably hoping against hope that the already compromised Ellen would catch cholera and that this would end her life. And to add to all Ellen's woes, at this time she started to develop stomach problems, probably due to the lack of nutrition and the damp and dirty surroundings she was in. She was only able to eat a small amount of salted beef and brown bread to try and sustain herself. Her health was rapidly deteriorating. And of course, she was still paranoid that he was somehow trying to poison her. Charles, of course, was hoping that this evidence of her indiscretion with Thomas would be enough to secure the divorce he so desired, opening the way for him to marry Anna if his other plan failed. But what he did not realise was that Ellen's alleged indiscretions would only grant him a divorce, a mesna e toro, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, which basically means that it is a divorce that forbids the husband and the wife from living together, but does not dissolve the marriage bond. If Charles wanted to marry Anna, he would have to get a divorce, a vinculo matrimoni. This is the termination of the marriage based on marital misconduct or any other statutory cause arising from the marriage ceremony, meaning after this, Charles would be single again and free to do what he wanted. But there was a catch. This course of action was very costly and required a minor act of parliament. Charles had then offered her £30 a year if she agreed to a divorce, but she rejected this offer after consulting with her family, who said she should get at least double that amount. Some 17 days after throwing Ellen out of the house, Charles was away for a few days to collect his sister, who was coming to stay with him for a while to run the house. He had also written a letter to Anna asking for a reconciliation. In this time, Ellen took the opportunity to return home for some comfort and food, and on the advice of her lawyer, who advised her that in order to secure any assets, she needed to be still living in the house. Despite major reservations for very obvious reasons, Ellen made the decision to return to the house. A very brave move indeed. Or was it? She was so sick at this stage, mentally and physically, but nevertheless she returned. The maid that had been there had resigned after she left and a new maid was in her place. When Charles did return with his sister, Mrs. Lydia Jackson, a few days later, he was enraged to see Ellen in the house and ordered her back into the attic. He also wrote a letter to Ellen's brother-in-law, who had advised him previously, saying that he should withdraw his offer of £30 a year and his only offer should be £21. This was only 10 days before her death. The doctors had visited Ellen after her return to the house and they found her condition to be worsening. And then eventually on the 1st of May 1849, Ellen's body could no longer take it and she passed away. And of course, this was the day that James Carroll received the letter from Charles that had been written 3 days previous. After Ellen's death, her nephew, who was the son of the Reverend Poe, also came forward with his suspicions to the coroner and requesting an inquest. He was also convinced his aunt had been poisoned. So a mere few hours after Ellen had died, the inquest is ordered to be carried out at the home of Charles Langley. It was adjourned until the following day at the local schoolhouse. An autopsy was performed on Ellen's remains in front of several witnesses. Meanwhile, at the inquest, the doctors who attended to Ellen gave evidence, both advising that they were sure Ellen had died from cholera. Some of the jury members were not convinced, though. Through various witness statements, it became clear that Ellen had thought she was being poisoned. But she was not the only one that thought this. Others had their suspicions too. The inquest was adjourned for a few days, but people were beginning to have their doubts as the stories began to trickle out. A few days after the adjournment, a group of women arrived outside Charles's house, shouting abuse and throwing stones, insisting on him opening the door. He had warned the new maid not to, but when they started threatening to break down the door, he relented and the maid opened it. They wanted to pay their respects to Ellen, who they assumed was laid out at the house. Of course, they were expecting to see her laid out in all her finery in an expensive coffin in the parlour, like was usual at any Irish wake of the time, but were horrified to see Charles had put Ellen's body outside in the garden and thrown a carriage hood over her to hide the body. Her burial was equally as controversial. Ellen was buried in a pauper's grave in the local graveyard, where her brother-in-law was the reverend, in a cheap wooden coffin with no marking at her graveside. One would think, if you were the distrusting kind, that Charles did not care a jot for his wife and wanted to act like she never even existed. The Saturday after the funeral, the inquest recommenced and the Crown started calling their witnesses. The following day, Mary Ann's husband, Nixon, Ellen's brother-in-law, unexpectedly died. He had been the lawyer who was giving divorce advice to Charles. A letter from Charles had arrived for Nixon and Mary Ann read it out at the inquest. The letter was cutting in its description of Charles's feelings towards Ellen. He also wrote about his plans to get rid of her. He had written a similarly incriminating letter to Anna. All the evidence to prove Charles was the reason for Ellen's demise was contained in both letters. His hostile intentions and feelings laid bare in these letters. The Crown had been instructed that all they needed for a guilty verdict was to show that Charles had accelerated Ellen's death, which I think we can safely say is definitely true. Several of his medical colleagues also stated in their examination by the Crown that they felt Charles's treatment of Ellen had a very negative impact on her health. Even Dr. Quinn, who had backed Charles, had changed his approach, stating that a diet of salted beef and brown bread had only accelerated her death when he knowingly gave it to her when she had bowel issues. Dr. Quinn concluding, "I am of the opinion that her death was accelerated by bad treatment and being placed in inferior lodgings." This was a big turnabout considering his findings of no evidence of malnutrition at the autopsy. Another witness testified that Ellen had requested a visit from her sister Frances a few days before she died. But Charles would only allow this if he was present. He was probably worried about what Ellen would say to her sister. Ultimately, this visit never happened and Ellen was dead a few days later. After the inquest was concluded, after 3 days of testimony and several adjournments, because the jury just couldn't reach a verdict, had she died from TB, in which case Dr. Quinn would say was the reason she was prescribed prussic acid, or cyanide as we know it today? Or had Dr. Langley used this poison to kill her? Had it been a combination of malnutrition, cold and damp lodgings and poison? The jury retired after the final statements and after a few short hours returned with their verdict. We find that Mrs. Eleanor Langley came by her death in consequences of a bowel complaint brought on by unnatural and diabolical treatment received at the hands of her husband, Charles Langley, and of which she died at Nina, the 1st of May. We therefore find the said Charles Langley guilty of manslaughter. On hearing this verdict, James Carroll immediately issued a warrant for the arrest of Dr. Langley and included a description of his appearance, as Charles had not been present that day at the inquest, and it would later be found out that he had taken this opportunity to abscond. The papers were full of his description and the fact that he had disappeared, and after 10 days in hiding, he was eventually captured at an undisclosed location in Dublin and was committed to Newgate Jail. He was, after this, granted bail and was temporarily free and went to stay at the Shelburne Hotel. In this time, he decided that he was going to hand himself in and ask for an early trial. He wrote a letter to the Nina Guardian explaining why he had made this decision. The letter stated, "Dear Sir, as mispresentation is the order of the day, I wish to inform you that before you will have received this, I shall have surrendered myself to the governor of Nina Jail and will therefore feel obliged by your not inserting that I was arrested or that I was brought there in the custody of the police, but that I had given myself up of my own free will and that I had been induced to do so thus early in order that the Crown may have no reasonable grounds for postponing my trial, which I am anxious should take place as soon as possible, when I trust I shall be able to rebut by most respectable testimony the horrid and revolting evidence given on the inquest, at which I was not present. If it were not for my anxiety to vindicate my character by having a trial at once, I would not surrender until the very last day. Your very obedient, humble servant, C. Langley, MD." After taking a train from Dublin to Temple Moor, Langley took a coach and was accompanied by four other people, including his brother-in-law, George Jackson. After arriving in Nina, they drove through the town and straight to the jail, where the doctor surrendered himself to the governor. On Friday, the 27th of July, 20 men were sworn in to adjudicate over the trial, which could potentially see Dr. Langley being hung if found guilty. And so began the trial of Dr. Charles Langley for the death of his wife, Ellen. The defence's case largely focused on downplaying Charles's mistreatment of his wife and was more focused on medical evidence, stating that the exact cause of the stomach and bowel ailments could not be properly proven. They could also not establish at the autopsy if poison had definitely been administered to Ellen on top of all her other issues. The defence went on to say that Charles's treatment of his wife was due to the wrongs that had been done to him and impropriety on her part. They also focused a lot on her alleged infidelity, trying to twist the words in the letter from Charles to Nixon, saying, "The letter proves that about this time disclosures had been made that led this most unfortunate man to the conviction that the person to whom he had been united for so many years had been criminally intimate with other men before he married her." They were trying to make out that once Charles found out about his wife's alleged past, this was when his behaviour towards her quite naturally changed. The defence asked the jury to conceive what must have been his state of mind, knowing that this woman of improper character had been pawned upon him. And then, of course, there was Thomas Pound. The defence used all these alleged incidents as a reason why Charles cast Ellen out to fend for herself. She had dishonoured her husband. The defence saying, "Let me ask you, had he reason to believe that a person of bad character had been put upon him in marriage? Are not these great palliatives for what he did? He acted harshly, no doubt, in sending her away, but who would not have done similarly?" This argument, of course, was of its time and showed the male standing in a marriage, where the wife was merely a possession and it was his right to punish her for her sins. Charles dominated the marriage and had complete control. He dictated who Ellen could see, where she would sleep, what she wore, and what and where she ate. He also had complete control over all the money, including the money she had brought into the marriage. But the defence hoped that this argument to the male jury would be enough to get Charles off the hook. The prosecution had their suspicions about poisoning. As I said, Charles had probably used cyanide to poison Ellen. But by the time the autopsy was performed, it was some 8 hours after she had died, and any traces of the poison would have been well and truly gone. So there was no way of proving that this had actually happened. The inquest could not definitively say she had been poisoned and was leaning more towards malnutrition and bowel issues as the cause of her death. But as the trial progressed and the public became aware of all that had happened to Ellen within the marriage, there was a public outcry, even after they found out about Ellen's alleged unfaithfulness. In these times, it was considered a much greater sin for the woman to be unfaithful than the man. Although the fact that Charles had been unfaithful in this particular case and held the torch for Anna was considered motive. After the closing speeches, of which the defence took 3 solid hours, the jury retired to deliberate and Charles was returned to the jail to await their decision. 3 hours later, at 5 o'clock that evening, the jury returned to the courtroom. Charles had been asleep and had to be woken to come and hear the verdict. He continued to nod off until somebody tapped him on the shoulder to wake up. The head juror came forward and handed the issue paper with the verdict written on it. Everyone in the courtroom had their breath held as Charles stood up to hear his fate. Not guilty. There is nothing written of Charles's immediate reaction to the verdict, but the Freeman Journal reported afterwards that he exhibited a number of arsenic pills which he had concealed in the lining of his waistcoat, had the verdict not gone his way. Charles had done everything to get out of even going on trial in the first place. He had initially gone on the run, but was later arrested in Dublin. He then paid his bail and was free until the decision was made to upgrade his charges from manslaughter to murder, as it was believed that Charles had showed intent. Because of this, he was rearrested and spent a year in prison while the defence prepared for trial. Being a murder charge, the death penalty was also a possibility. All the while, Charles had protested his innocence and had even gone on hunger strike for 38 days. It was around this time that the letter from Anna appeared, which initiated all the evidence to be looked over again by the new jury. This jury, a predominantly Protestant one, downgraded its charges to manslaughter again, and as we know, after the trial, he was found not guilty. What Charles did in the immediate aftermath of his release is up for debate. Some say he remained in his cell until the proceedings were completely finished with. Other rumours stated that he was in the jail hospital, while some newspapers reported that he took a suite at the Brundley Hotel in Neenah and spent the night celebrating with close friends. The papers were full of outcry at how he had basically walked free from court, with one headline in the London Times saying, "Is murder by torture a crime?" But nevertheless, Charles was defiant in nature after being acquitted and determined to get on with his life. Both he and Anna effectively disappeared from Neenah after the events, and there is no reference to her or Charles there after 1850. Anna appeared to be effectively wiped from her family history. In Burke's Genealogical and Heraldic Dictionary, which published a new edition in 1863, in the Poe family record, her name is omitted, but it did include all of her siblings. She is also not mentioned in her brother James's will. She was effectively wiped from the family history. Charles appears to have suffered the same fate, even though he had vowed that he would remain in Neenah after being acquitted. But public opinion towards him remained hostile and made it unsuitable for him to live there. The last known account of the two of them was when their marriage was announced in the Freeman's Journal in June of 1850. It stated, "At Chester, Charles Langley Esquire to Anna Matilda, daughter of the Reverend James Hill Poe, rector of Neenah, County Tipperary." Evidently, the ceremony took place in the Church of St. Oswald's in Chester on the 4th of June, only 3 months after the acquittal for the murder of his wife. The only people present were 2 witnesses, a servant and the parish clerk. It's unbelievable, really, that Anna went through with the marriage, as she obviously detested what Charles had done to her aunt and his treatment of her. This is evident by the letter that he had wrote to her and that she gave to the court. So why did she go on to marry him? I suppose after the affair became public knowledge and the reaction both locally and nationally to their affair, her options had basically become very limited and she effectively had made her own bed and she had to lie in it. Charles, of course, ultimately got everything he wanted. He got rid of his wife, be it directly by poisoning her or indirectly by slowly starving her, and he got to be with Anna, even if she wasn't fully invested in the relationship. They would move to Liverpool in 1850 and had their first child, Jeremiah, in May of 1851. In the census recorded 10 years later, it showed they were living in a large house which had a dining room, a drawing room, and six bedrooms near Everton on the outskirts of Liverpool. So they were obviously doing well for themselves. They then went on to have a daughter, Annetta, who would have health issues. In 1858, they had another son, Charles, but he died from the whooping cough at 20 months old. So only their eldest son, Jeremiah, would survive. It is unknown whether he knew the backstory to their marriage. This was an unbelievable story to research. And to be honest, if I put all the details into the podcast would be a week long. At the end of it all, I feel so sorry for Ellen. She never got justice. Her life, once married to Charles, was one of misery and betrayal. Not just by him, but by her family as well, to a point. The only people that I could see that showed her true kindness were her servants. Even in death, she was shown no kindness, forever consigned to a pauper's grave, forgotten and unmarked. Charles got to live out his life and got everything he wanted in the end. So as I said, no justice for Ellen. So guys, what do you make of this story? Another doozy from our past history. At the very least, I suppose, for the time you've been listening to Ellen's story, we can say she's been remembered and the truth of Charles's real character has been exposed. So guys, that's it for today's episode of the Ireland Crimes and Mysteries podcast. Again, thanks for your listenership and don't forget to subscribe to the show and hit that auto download so you never miss an episode. Until the next time, keep your eyes open and your mind curious. This podcast has been compiled from information gathered in the public sphere, like news articles, documentaries, and open source material that can be found on the web. Everything in this podcast is alleged unless a conviction has taken place.
You've been listening to Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. Join Newell's for another episode coming real soon. And keep up to date by following our social media sites, our YouTube channel, and our website, islandcrimesandmysteries.ie.